This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
In a world overflowing with noise, shallow takes, and information that evaporates the moment you hear it, Selenius Media exists for one purpose: to give you depth. Whether the subject is philosophy, psychology, history, science, artificial intelligence, literature, or the shape of the future, every series we publish is built on one idea: that thinking clearly is a form of survival. Our catalog spans dozens of long-form, story-driven shows. From Western moral philosophy for beginners to pioneers of psychology and psychiatry. From AI, an uncertain future, to the classical music giants. Each series is crafted to give you more than facts. It gives you the context, the conflict, and the human meaning behind the ideas that shaped our world. If you enjoy this program, explore the rest of our library. Every show is designed to stand alone, but together they form a larger project, a guided tour of the forces, intellectual, emotional, political, technological, that built the world we live in and the world we're about to enter. Visit the Selenius Media channel to discover new series, follow your favorites, and support the work that allows us to create long-form, high-fidelity educational storytelling. And please leave comments if you enjoy our shows. Now, let's begin. A young man sits in a garden in North Africa in the late 4th century of our era, sobbing. He is not poor, not powerless, not stupid. He has a respectable job teaching rhetoric in Milan. He has friends. He has read widely in philosophy. By the standards of his time, he is a success. And yet, he cannot stop crying because he feels divided against himself. He wants one kind of life and lives another. He knows, or thinks he knows, what is good, but he keeps choosing something else. Grant me chastity and continence, he once prayed, half joking. But not yet. Now the joke has worn thin. In the garden, tween tears, he hears a child's voice chanting from somewhere nearby. Take and read. Take and read. He picks up a book lying close at hand, opens at random, and reads a passage that feels like a command to change his life. This is the scene that will become famous as the turning point of Augustine of Hippo, one of the most influential thinkers in Western moral history. Augustine was born in 354 CE in Thagaste, a small provincial town in Roman North Africa in what is now Algeria. His father, Patricius, was a minor official and a pagan until late in life. His mother, Monica, was a devout Christian. The household was mixed, Latin-speaking, proud of Roman identity, but also deeply shaped by local African culture and the still young Christian movement. From his mother, Augustine absorbed stories of saints and martyrs, the importance of prayer, the idea of a God who cares intimately about individual lives. From his father and the wider Roman world, he absorbed ambition, the desire to rise to education and eloquence. As a boy, Augustine excelled in his studies. He hated the harsh discipline of the schools, but loved language. In his confessions, he remembers how the stories of Virgil moved him more than the content of the Bible did when he was young. He cried over the death of Dido in the Aeneid, yet felt no similar tears for his own spiritual state. Already we see a theme that will run through his moral psychology: the power of desire and imagination to attach themselves to images, narratives, and honors, and the difficulty of reordering that attachment toward what is genuinely good. He went on to study rhetoric, the art of persuasive speech, in Carthage, the major city of Roman Africa. There he plunged into what he later calls a cauldron of lusts, sexual affairs, theatrical entertainments, competitive friendships, and the intoxicating thrill of performing and being admired. He took a concubine, with whom he lived for many years and had a son, Adeodatus. He was not yet interested in marriage. His career came first. He wanted, more than anything, to be admired as a great orator, to win cases, to shine in public life. At the same time, he was tormented by intellectual questions. The Christianity of his childhood seemed to him crude and unsatisfying. The Bible, as he first encountered it, struck him as simplistic compared to the polished Latin of classical authors. He was especially vexed by the problem of evil. If God is all-powerful and good, why is there so much suffering, injustice, and sin? In his late teens and 20s, he found an answer he thought promising in Manichaeism, a dualistic religion that divided reality into a realm of light, good, and a realm of darkness, evil. On this view, the world is a battleground between two co-eternal principles, and human beings are sites where light and darkness are mixed. Evil, then, is not a mere absence, but a real active force. Augustine became a hearer in the Manichaean community for nearly 10 years, drawn by its moral rigor and its promise to explain the universe in rational terms. Manichaeism, however, began to disappoint him. Its leaders could not give him the intellectual depth he sought. The more he studied philosophy, especially Neoplatonism, the less plausible the Manichaean picture of two equal gods fighting seemed. Gradually, he began to turn away from it. He moved from Carthage to Rome and then to Milan, where he secured a prestigious post as a rhetorician. There he met Bishop Ambrose, a powerful preacher and politician. Ambrose's sermons were the first time Augustine heard Christianity presented with literary finesse and intellectual sophistication. Ambrose read scripture allegorically, finding philosophical depth beneath the surface stories. This cracked open Augustine's earlier contempt for the Bible. At the same time, Augustine was reading Plotinus and other Platonist writers in Latin translation. From them, he learned to think of God not as a being among others, but as being itself, the source of all that exists, absolutely simple and good. He learned that evil could be understood not as a positive substance, but as a privation, a lack of due order or goodness in something that is, in itself, good as a creature. This idea hit him with enormous force. It allowed him to release the idea of a rival evil principle, and to see the world as a hierarchy of goods, where some things are higher, some lower, and misuse of the will is what produces moral evil.
But knowing this did not immediately change his life. He famously describes himself as torn in two wills. He was convinced by the Christian Platonist picture intellectually, but his habits of desire were still shaped by ambition, sensuality, and social pressure. He considered marriage, but was told he needed to send away his longtime partner and wait for a more advantageous match. This tore him deeply. He loved her, but he obeyed the social and familial logic that placed career and status above everything. She returned to Africa. He was left behind, his son with him, his heart wounded. He took another mistress rather than remain celibate. I was in love with loving, he later said. In this period, Augustine's moral life becomes an extraordinary case study in weakness of will, or akrasia, a topic ancient philosophers had long discussed in more abstract terms. How is it possible to recognize the better and yet do the worse? Plato and Aristotle had offered various analyses, but Augustine gives the phenomenon a new emotional and introspective depth. He describes sitting in that garden in Milan, unable to move, feeling like two selves, one whispering, later, later, and another crying out for release. His problem was not ignorance, but bondage. He knew what he should do, but felt he could not do it. The turning point in the garden, the take and read episode, is significant less as a magical moment than as a crystallization of a long process. The passage he read from Paul's letter to the Romans urged him to abandon revelry and drunkenness, debauchery and licentiousness, quarrels and jealousy, and to put on the Lord Jesus Christ. He felt, he says, as if a light of certainty flooded his heart, and his resistance broke. He decided to be baptized, to give up his rhetorical career, and to live a life oriented explicitly toward God. He returned to Africa, eventually became a priest and then Bishop of Hippo, and spent the rest of his life preaching, writing, and struggling against various heresies. For Western moral philosophy, Augustine matters not just because he became a saint in the Christian tradition, but because of the way he integrated Roman, Platonic, and biblical elements into a new moral psychology. His most famous line from the opening of the Confessions captures the core of his vision. You have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you. Human beings on this view are not just rational animals or political animals. We are desiring animals whose deepest orientation is toward God as our ultimate good. Our restlessness, our endless seeking of satisfaction in sex, money, power, knowledge, art, is not random. It is the mark of a nature oriented beyond any finite thing. The problem is not that we desire, but that our loves are misdirected. This is where Augustine's notion of ordered love becomes central. Morality, for him, is not primarily about following rules. It is about having the right order of loves. To love rightly is to love things according to their true worth, to love God above all, to love other people in God, to love oneself as a creature of God, and to love created goods, food, art, beauty, institutions, without clinging to them as ultimate. Sin in this framework is disordered love, loving lower goods as if they were highest, or loving oneself more than the source of one's being. Take, for example, the love of praise. The desire to be recognized is, in itself, not evil. Augustine admits he still feels pleasure when people praise his sermons. But if that desire becomes his main driver, if he begins to preach not to speak truth or help others, but to win acclaim, then his love has become disordered. He has put a lower good, human approval, where a higher good, God and truth, should be. He sees the same pattern in greed, lust, and even in intellectual pride. The mind that delights more in its own cleverness than in the truth it discovers has turned inward in a twisted way. This diagnosis reshapes class.
This podcast is supported by The RealReal.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Classic philosophical questions. Where a Stoic might focus on which impressions to assent to and which roles to inhabit virtuously, Augustine focuses on where the heart is actually attached. He does not deny the importance of reason. In fact, he elevates it as a gift from God. But he is acutely aware that the will can resist what reason shows, and that emotion and habit often override judgment. The battle for the good life is not just an argument. It is a slow re-education of love. Augustine also deepens the concept of will itself. Earlier philosophers had talked about choice and rational desire, but he gives the will a central, almost dramatic role. The will is the power by which we adhere to something, the interior yes or no, that aligns us with one path or another. It can be bent, divided, healed. He describes his younger self as having two wills, one old, one new, fighting inside him. This conflict is not between reason and feeling exactly, but between different configurations of love within the will. Conversion, in his account, is not merely coming to hold the right opinions. It is the reorientation of the will toward God. This leads to one of Augustine's most controversial doctrines, original sin. Reading Paul and reflecting on his own weakness, he concludes that the human will, after the first disobedience of Adam, is not simply neutral. It is wounded, turned inward on itself, prone to pride and concupiscence. We are born into a state where we cannot, by our own power, consistently will the good. Grace, God's gratuitous help, is necessary to heal and free the will. Without grace, we can perform some socially decent actions, but we cannot achieve the deep, rightly ordered love that constitutes true justice. For moral philosophy, this has both dark and hopeful sides. Dark, because it means we cannot simply educate our way out of moral failure. There is a structural damage in the will that no amount of self-help or civic exhortation can fully repair. Hopeful, because Augustine insists that this damage does not annihilate our nature. We remain capable of response. Grace does not force us, it woos and strengthens. The will is healed not by being overridden, but by being drawn into a new love. From a secular point of view, you can translate some of this language into the recognition that human beings often find themselves unable to do what they sincerely approve. Addiction, compulsion, self-sabotage. Augustine's introspective honesty about these phenomena feels startlingly modern. He refuses the flattering picture of humans as rational agents who merely need good information. He knows, from his time in Carthage and Milan that you can know all sorts of admirable things and still stay stuck. The question then becomes, what, if anything, can change desire at its root? Augustine's answer is explicit faith in Christ and participation in the sacramental life of the Church. But even if you bracket that theological content, his structure remains suggestive. Desire is transformed not by argument alone, but by some encounter that reconfigures what we find beautiful and worthy. For him, that encounter is with divine beauty experienced inwardly. In one of the most famous passages in the Confessions, he addresses God as beauty ever ancient, ever new, and laments that he loved created beauties while he was far from the unchanging source of beauty itself. Once he tasted that source, his other loves had to be reordered. This inwardness does not, for Augustine, exempt him from public responsibilities as Bishop of Hippo.
Is deeply involved in pastoral care, church politics, and debates with rival groups, Manichaeans, Donatists, Pelagians. He writes sermons about everyday virtues, honesty in business, fidelity in marriage, care for the poor. He famously argues that the state has a limited and tragic role. It can maintain a kind of earthly peace by restraining worse evils, but it cannot create the true peace that comes only from rightly ordered love. His city of God contrasts the earthly city. Formed by love of self to the point of contempt for God, with the heavenly city, formed by love of God to the point of contempt for self. These cities interpenetrate history. They are not identical to any political entity. This analysis will shape Christian attitudes toward politics for centuries. Skeptical of utopian projects, wary of making any regime into a sacred order, insistent that moral transformation begins in the heart. His view of history also reframes moral striving. Against cyclical Greek views, he sees history as a linear drama with a beginning, fall, long struggle, and eventual consummation. That timeline can be used, badly, to justify passivity. If God is in charge, why act? Augustine resists that temptation by insisting that our choices matter, even if we do not control ultimate outcomes. The story is larger than us, but we are not irrelevant. Our acts of justice, mercy, and humility are real contributions to the unfolding of the city of God, even if they are not recorded in any earthly chronicle. If you step back and look at Augustine as a character in your series, you can see him as the one who, more than anyone before him, internalizes moral life. Socrates and Plato had already pointed inward. The Stoics had stressed inner ascent. But Augustine gives us a richly textured inner landscape populated with memories, fantasies, competing loves, temptations, subtle self-deceptions. He invents, in a sense, the genre of spiritual autobiography, and in doing so, gives later Western thinkers a template for exploring conscience, guilt, and transformation. When Rousseau or Kierkegaard, or even some contemporary memoirist, writes about their inner conflicts, Augustine is in the background. His emphasis on love as the core of ethics will echo in many later thinkers. Medieval scholastics will elaborate systems of virtues, vices, and laws, but often return to Augustine's idea that what ultimately defines a person is what they love and how. Even modern philosophers wary of theology have felt his pull. Hannah Arendt, for example, wrote her doctoral dissertation on Augustine's concept of love and returned to it when thinking about the conditions for a plural political world. His analysis of pride as the root of many evils, pride understood as the will to be one's own God, to be self-sufficient, is another theme that recurs across the centuries. Of course, Augustine also passes on some more troubling legacies.
a suspicion of sexual desire that can harden into hostility to the body, a pessimistic view of human nature that can be used to justify harsh discipline, an emphasis on divine grace that can shade into fatalism. For your listeners, part of the task will be to see both sides, the extraordinary honesty and depth of his self-examination, and the ways in which his conclusions reflect the tensions of his own time, late empire, doctrinal conflict, personal struggle. Imagine him near the end of his life, an old bishop in Hippo, as the Roman world in the West is collapsing. Vandals are besieging his city. He is sick, reading the penitential psalms pinned to his wall, praying, dictating letters. The grand imperial structures that had framed his youth are falling apart. Yet he does not think the moral world is ending. For him, the real drama of love and will continues wherever human hearts turn toward or away from God. His own heart, once in love with loving in the theaters of Carthage, now finds its rest in a reality he cannot see with bodily eyes. For Western moral philosophy, Augustine leaves behind several crucial ideas: that the deepest questions of ethics are questions about love, that moral failure is not just ignorance but a wounded will, that evil is a privation, not a rival substance, that the inner life with all its contradictions is not a distraction from philosophy but one of its primary data. Whether one shares his faith or not, living in a culture shaped by his errors means living in a world where conscience, guilt, confession, and the drama of inner conflict are part of how we talk about right and wrong.
Midnight rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. The horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Thank you. nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Thank you.